their seat to the session, please. If you're not taking part in this session, could you please leave the auditorium so that we can get started?
Thank you. Gotta love it while I'm trying that next.
We're going to get started now. So hello and welcome to this session, the first session after the plenary session, which has kicked us all off to a very nice start. My name's Margaret Florey, and I'm going to be chairing the two papers in this session. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Jeannie Bell, who's going to be our first speaker. Jeannie is a senior lecturer at Bachelor Institute for Indigenous Tertiary Education in the Northern Territory, Australia. And Jeannie's speaking about strengthening Australia's Indigenous languages, the relationship between community and linguists.
I think I probably need to get you clicked on, Jeannie. Someone's done it.
My name is Jeannie Bell, and I would like to pay my respects and honour the traditional people of this land that we're on today, and thank them for the beautiful welcome that they gave us this morning. I'm a Doonburra Yugara person from southeast Queensland in eastern Australia, and I am very privileged to be here today speaking about Aboriginal languages and the relationship between our people in communities and linguists who work with our communities in Australia. I am a qualified linguist, a trained linguist, university trained linguist. I worked in a number of Aboriginal communities, but most specifically focused on my own languages in Southeast Queensland, and currently working on a language from Southwest Queensland. That song that I just sang a small part of is a song that we sing, and traditionally it was sung to ask permission to come onto somebody else's country. And it today is sung by many groups in our area of Southeast Queensland as a welcoming song and a farewell song. And it's very commonly known and very commonly sung by many groups, both with a corroboree, a dance that goes with it, or else just as a song of welcome or hello, and in this case for me, to ask permission. And obviously permission was granted before I asked it, so I thank them very much for having us here. And I thank you for being here too. And what I am looking at today is, in the very short time that we have, is about the relationship between communities and in relation to language work, specifically endangered language work that's happening on Aboriginal languages in Australia. And my focus for the purposes of the paper that I'm writing in conjunction with the presentation has been on Aboriginal women, including my own work. And I haven't finished the paper because I'm having a few problems with myself in terms of, you know, some of the issues that I'm trying to write about. And it's just about kind of, you know, working things out in my head before I come to some conclusion. But I've got a PowerPoint that I'm going to try and speak to so that I can get through some of the points. And the first one, will I just clip this? Yep. Is to look at the current situation in Australia and to give a quick overview of what's going on at the moment. So the language situation in Australia was that 200 years ago, a little bit more and maybe less even, We had between 250 to 300 distinct Aboriginal families and Aboriginal language families that were spoken across the continent of Australia, which included the islands off the coast of Australia. There are other Indigenous languages now identified or recognised in Australia, which are those of the Torres Strait Islands, which are to the north of Australia. The languages aren't exactly related. Some of them are, but not necessarily directly, because some of the Torres Strait languages are more related to Papua New Guinea languages. The situation today is that we have less than 100 languages being spoken in any form at all, and probably only 20 to 30 of those languages which are what would be considered relatively healthy, with language speaker numbers between perhaps, 50 to 500 in some cases. And if we have communities, like in the Northern Territory where I live and my colleagues that are here today live and work, there are probably language groups in the Northern Territory and in some of the bordering states of Australia where we do have at least perhaps, languages that have up to 500, 600 speakers today. There is concern about the state of the languages, obviously. Grave concern, because in a global situation of languages dying by the week, endangered languages dying by the week, Australia apparently has got the highest rate of language loss at this particular time in looking at language situations and language survival into the future. I guess my concerns about the relationship between Aboriginal communities, but specifically in the case of this presentation, it's about the relationship between the Aboriginal language workers that are working with linguists, or linguists that aren't Aboriginal that are working on Australian languages, both past and present, have worked and are working today on languages. It's the relationship that's developed over time between language workers and linguists. Sometimes we call ourselves community linguists, sometimes we call ourselves linguists, and community people who work as language workers, and in some cases have had training and in other cases just work because they have a knowledge of the language, maybe not a full knowledge, but certainly some knowledge of the language, and in a lot of cases they obviously have a passion and a concern and commitment to see the languages survive into the future. So obviously this involves some work in relation to working with linguists who know the language or who are willing to give some assistance to interpret documentation on the language, and we're in the same cases or the same situation as many people today working with endangered languages, particularly in relation to revival and reclamation of language. We're working from historical sources in a lot of cases. We sometimes have tape material, sometimes we don't. We quite often might have a grammar description, and even in other cases there may have been a learner's guide done in more recent times when the learner's guides became more popular. What I'm focusing on particularly, and this is in relation to something that's been simmering, I think, for probably the last decade or more, are some of the tensions that arise in these relationships, these language-committed relationships, where, of course, the linguists come in generally from a very good point of being, well-intentioned and wanting to help and support the work that's being done in the community, but nonetheless, despite that, there are always tensions that do come up in these working relationships and situations. And I guess I'm talking a lot from my own experience in this case, but also I know many people. One of the jobs that we do in the Bachelor Institute of Indigenous Tertiary Education, where Gail and Marie and I both all work, is that we teach Indigenous people from all around Australia and the Torres Strait to train in higher education course in language and linguistics, and we also do work which is at a different level, what we call the VET level, vocational education and training level, for community people still living on their country in a lot of cases, to learn to read and write in their own language, and also to be able to make materials to help the to support the teaching of the language in their communities, and also to encourage younger generations to participate in language use and language learning and language survival into the future. So the reasons why the tensions arise are often because people are coming at the project or the program that's being developed in a community from a different motivational point, if you like. People are there because they, in the one case, I'll flick over to the next screen, They're there, you know, in the case of community people, like I said earlier, they're highly motivated or passionate about the language. They still remember some of the language, or they may in some cases know the language quite well and speak it on a regular basis when they get the opportunities, because even sometimes in communities, opportunities aren't always there when the majority of the community have already switched to other languages. I guess I didn't complete the scenario of the language situation in Australia, so I should do that briefly. At the moment, across the north of the whole of the north of the Australian continent, the majority of Indigenous people, which includes Torres Strait Islanders as well as Aboriginal people, speak a number of varieties of a Creole language. And the estimated figures of the number of people who speak it as their first language is somewhere between 40 to 50,000. And there are a number of varieties of that language. And at the moment in the Northern Territory, the Creole language is slowly creeping down into the centre. So it's a very rapidly spreading language, and unfortunately quite often is replacing traditional languages in many, many ways and in many cases, you know. The rest of the population of Aboriginal Australia is speaking quite often standard English, because that's the primary language of Australia and it's the official language, obviously. But in also many cases we speak many dialectal varieties of Aboriginal English, what we call Aboriginal English. In a lot of the situations where language revival is happening, people remember words and know songs. They, you know, do dances. They remember lots of words, and these are kind of intermixed within either Aboriginal English or standard English in a lot of cases as well. So just looking at some of the issues that come up when you think about the tensions that are arising, and, you know, you hear it voiced at gatherings like this quite often in Australia, when Indigenous people and linguists come together, it becomes a little bit of a forum for voicing some of the angst and some of the resentments that people feel about linguists coming into their community and taking material and then leaving. And the question of being a language activist, I think, comes into play here, because it is the people who come to the conferences that are concerned about their languages and that are not only working either to get training themselves to continue their work and advance their own knowledge of the language, but also they're the ones that go to political meetings and bring up the issues around language endangerment and language loss. The need for schools to be more supportive of language teaching in schools across Australia, which doesn't happen very widely. Certainly in the Northern Territory, there's been a history of bilingual education in the last 40 years, since about 1972 or 73, but the current Northern Territory government are threatening at the moment, and it looks fairly likely that they will change the policy so that the two-way education or bilingual education gets kind of demoted, if you like, down to a fairly minimal level of first language teaching in the school classrooms. I've only got 10 minutes left, so I better hurry up. Negative stereotypes of linguists working with languages past and present is something that people carry with them for a long time. You know, it's handed down over generations, and people feel this real grief of loss, and it's a real feeling of, like, we've been robbed, you know. They've taken our land, they've taken our culture, and they've taken our languages, and we're here trying to work out how we're going to get it all back. And in a lot of cases, one of the speakers who spoke earlier, you know, we're trying to put together all these bits and pieces that have been grabbed from here and there, and in very systematic ways, you know, and quite often given back to us in dictionaries and documented tapes and materials that a lot of people don't understand. It's not easily accessible. It's not easy for people to just pick up a book and go, oh, this is fantastic, now I can work out how to say so-and-so, or this is this and this is that. You know, quite often it needs the linguist to come along and help. And in many cases, the linguist might already be working on the language because they've taken an interest. Like I say, that the linguist, it's on another page, but the motivation of linguists quite often is to come into a community or to choose to work with a particular language or language community because they're interested in a particular you know, grammatical aspect of the language, or they're interested in comparative linguistics or whatever it may be, but they're quite often driven by that motivation. And I think in recent years that's changed quite a bit too. I think that some of the things that Nicholas was saying this morning about the nature of documentary linguistics and descriptive linguistics has fallen into play in many ways, because linguists are now very concerned about the global situation of endangered languages and the work that is needed urgently to try and keep some of those languages alive. But again, while that is happening, you've got more and more Indigenous people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the case of Australia, who are training to also participate in that work and wanting to have more of a say. And I think that it's not only about having a say, it's about having a real role, you know, being able to kind of meaningfully participate in projects and to be recognised and respected for the contribution that they bring and also that they make. And the community people, the elders who still know the language, and the people who are interested in the language and want to participate in some small way by teaching the language to younger people in their family or in their community, by bringing people together in situations and occasions when language can be used. And, you know, quite often in urban situations, which is where I grew up, in an urban situation, and my beautiful niece here who lives in Hawaii today, but, you know, we have memories of, you know, being in the park in Brisbane, you know, and people singing Garang and Nami and dancing. I mean, it's not something that we would, you know, denied. It was still there. And when I was a child in the 1950s, people still spoke language in the city. You know, people who came from the reservations or the what we call the missions, the church missions, they, you know, they were still speaking language. So we were still privileged for that, you know, decade or so when they were still around, and when they passed away, obviously it became less and less. But it's not there, it's not that it's not there altogether. So it's about trying to heal the grief, you know, between within communities, because I'm not saying that the grief is directed just at non-Indigenous linguists. We cop it too. You know, people say, well, who are you? You know, who do you think you can do? Why do you think you've got the right to do this? Or, you know, how come you haven't included my family? Or why haven't you asked so-and-so? And you've talked to the wrong person, and that's not the way our family talk, and this and da-da-da-da-da. It goes on and on and on. So it's not just about, you know, being a non-Indigenous linguist. It also happens with us as well. So the other point I really wanted to make was that Aboriginal linguists are most probably coming more from the angle of doing things practical. You know, they want to do projects through song and dance. They want to do projects through multimedia, and they love the multimedia. We all know that the kids love the multimedia, especially having DVDs, taking people on cultural exchange trips or just cultural trips to their homeland if they're not living on country, being able to, you know, record and film and video all those kind of events so kids can see it. You know, played back to them over and over and over again. Having language classes where they can do practical things, you know, to make posters or make cards or just make up songs themselves, or to be able to do all that and learn the language at the same time is a really important thing. And in the context of communities where language is still being spoken on a regular basis, like it is in Central Australia where Gail works, in Alice Springs in Australia, people are using the language all the time, but it's not always being passed down to the lower generations because people are resisting it in some way, or the children are not feeling that it's relevant to their lives today. But the language workers and linguists, including, you know, people that are training and have got higher education qualifications in language and linguistics, are still trying to work very closely, and mostly are working very closely with community elders and other people that are interested. And there's sometimes a little bit of tension there in terms of what the linguist might want to do or might see as necessary coming together. And it isn't just language programs, it's also research projects. And there's a whole big thing about research today in Indigenous context, and I've struggled with this paper in terms of putting it within the framework of the Indigenous research methodologies that have, you know, emerged over the last 10 years or so, particularly Linda Tuiwa Smith's work from Aotearoa and other scholars in Australia today, Indigenous scholars in Australia, that are applying that framework very, you know, very meticulously, if you like, to the research work that they've been involved in and they see happening in the disciplines that they work in. And I haven't been aware of it being applied to language and linguistics or in the context of, you know, endangered languages in Indigenous communities. But I think that there certainly is scope for that to happen, and I guess I take some confidence that that is a legitimate thing to do when I hear about, you know, that we do many linguists work from a theoretical framework or some kind of basis when they're doing linguistic documentation and description, so, or unless, at least that those kind of methodologies and theories are arising more and more and being used. So I guess to finish off, I must be rushing through it now. What I want to say as a final thing is that, you know, I'm trying within the discussion that I'm having with myself and with other people, particularly other Aboriginal women that are working in the field, is working out ways that we can deal with these issues, and also the discussion extends to the linguists that we work with as well, because obviously it can't be a debate just with ourselves, or it can't be a discussion with ourselves. And looking at the tensions and where they're coming from, and I know that somebody mentioned yesterday, possibly Margaret, I think, when we had our discussion on the beach the other day, that, you know, some that a linguist in Canada had put forward the proposal, and I think an Indigenous linguist at that, that there has to be some healing that goes on before you can actually go into these projects, and that they can be truly collaborative and productive, because there are some tensions about what our community needs and wishes, what are the needs and wishes of the linguist that's working on the project, how do people truly respect and collaborate, you know, with each other when we're coming from quite different points of view or quite different standpoints. So I think it's the beginning of a discussion, or maybe the discussion has happened for your particular area, your particular region where you live, country where you live, but I think in Australia it's long overdue, and it comes up in a kind of confrontational way at the moment in conferences and meetings, and people get frightened, they feel threatened by it, and that's something that we also have to kind of avoid if we can. I mean, it isn't always going to be easy, and I guess it's just about trying to enhance positive working relationships into the future. And as a final fold-up of it, I looked yesterday, not yesterday, I just added this in yesterday, but I was looking at the guidelines for ethical research, which I've looked at before. This is the from the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, which is based in the capital of Australia, Canberra, and it's a fairly large research institution, which Jason and other people that are here at the conference work where they work, and I have been a member of the Research Advisory Committee there as a linguistics representative for the last 7 years up until the middle of last year. But these are three of the main principles, and someone pointed out, I think Marie yesterday pointed out, that they're fairly close to our both ways principles that we have in our strategic plan at Batchelor Institute, which is an Indigenous tertiary institution in the Northern Territory. So the three main principles were based around consultation, negotiation, mutual understanding, and respect, recognition and involvement, and benefits, outcomes and agreements. And obviously that's talking about the groups coming together and trying to work better, finding ways of working better together. And I think that, you know, we know that these things are happening, but we still have a bit of a way to go, and let's just hope the discussion can progress in really positive ways. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeannie. That's another great paper in this early stage of the conference to start lots of really interesting conversations. So I'd like to invite questions, and if people could come up to one of the microphones here, please. I think we've got about 7 or 8 minutes, so reasonable time for questions.
Thank you.
Don't strangle yourself on that.
No, I can really do.
Alice?
Presentation. I wonder if you would say a bit more about healing.
I guess it's not an area that I've got, I'd say that I have a lot of expertise in, but from my gut feeling of being an Aboriginal person who's, you know, grown up around big families and big communities, in our sense of big, you know, and then, you know, going off and doing university and all that kind of stuff, and having had the opportunity to travel and see lots of different scenarios around the country and around the globe. Not a lot in comparison to other people, but you know, for me it's been a lot. And I think that, you know, within our own communities we've got a lot of healing to do. You know, we have to heal the rifts between families, and we have to heal the rifts within families, you know, because there's a lot of people who think it's fantastic, like in my family, and I come from a big family, what we would call a big family, think it's fantastic that I do what I do. But if you really ask them if they knew what I did, they'd probably say no. They don't really know what I do. But they think it's good. And I have a fantastic cousin in our community in Harvey Bay, which is connected to an island that we're spiritually connected to and traditionally connected to, which is called Fraser Island, Gari. She's been teaching the language in the community for 10 years to children in the community. She brings them together every Sunday, and she has some young people working with her. I've been a bit of a mentor to her. You know, she's trained under me both formally and informally, and we've been learning the language together. I've been lucky enough to learn the language from tapes of one of our very old grandfathers, and that was part of my master's thesis that I did. But the thing is that I have another cousin who came to Bachelor recently to do a course, not connected to language, and you know, she used the opportunity to kind of ask me what Joy was doing. You know, what was she doing in this language program that she'd been doing for 10 years? You know, so there's a lot of healing that needs to go on. And the other cousin was saying, we haven't been included in the program. Nobody's told us what's happening. You know, you know, it's kind of like, so there's that level of healing, and there's other levels of healing. There's healing about just being able to get the grief out and express how we feel. You know, we've lost our language, we've lost our land, we've lost our culture, a lot of it. Not, you know, I don't believe that it's all gone, because I believe that what we do each day in our lives, our daily lives, if we live as Aboriginal people, we are doing culture, you know, and it's how we present ourselves, it's how we behave, the protocols that we adopt, the morals that we live by, you know, and how we look after our children or don't look after them, and how we teach them, you know, so there's a lot of that involved in it as well. And it's about kinship and all that stuff. But and then there's the healing between groups, you know, the linguists and the community, the linguists and the non-linguists and all the rest of it, you know. But it's kind of about finding ways to do that. And maybe it is just talking. Maybe it's coming together and talking, you know, one-to-one in groups or however we do it. But I guess we're just trying, some of us at least want to be heard more. We want to be able to feel like we're valued in a project or in a team when there's a research project going on. We like, you know, it's those sorts of things. And maybe we're reading the situation wrong. We need to be told, well, we're really trying to, but you're not really helping because you're not doing da-da-da. So, you know, there's all levels of healing. And I'm sure there are other people that have got takes on it as well. Yep.
We've got one question over here.
I'd like to thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Eva Tchaikovska Higgins from the University of Victoria on the west coast of Canada. And it's just extremely interesting and exciting to hear you talking about these issues from your perspective as a community linguist. I've been involved in a Community University Research Alliance project at UVic with local Salish communities, and the kinds of issues that you're raising are exactly the same ones that we're dealing with. And I think there's really a lot of work that needs to be done around relationship building. Mm. One of the things that you said a number of times, one of the words that you used a number of times was the word help. And from my own experience as a linguist working together with my colleagues in the Salish communities, I thought that word help is a problematic one, because if a linguist goes in with the intention of helping, that can have various kinds of ramifications that for issues of empowerment, who's in a position of privilege, and I was wondering if you'd just like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, I guess my answer would be that I still need to do some decolonization training, you know, like I need to get out of this missionary mentality, kind of victim mentality stuff. I mean, you know, that's some of the one of the biggest obstacles in a lot of ways is that we still see ourselves as always being helped or supported by other people who know better than us, you know, and myself as a person that has, you know, the experience that I've had and the education that I've had, still use words like that today without even thinking about it.
We all do that.
Yeah.
And
I guess it's probably just that all I'm saying is, or trying to say, or, you know, the comment that I guess I'm making is that we often need that assistance, and we have to work out ways to negotiate those relationships, you know, with the linguists, if it's the linguists that we want to work with. If it's technology people that we need, you know, there's, like it's been said earlier, it's a team approach, and it needs more and more to be a team approach, because it's not a one-man band or one-woman band show, these saving languages, obviously. But, yeah, it's about negotiation and building relationships.
My community colleagues say that the linguists need a lot of assistance.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you very much.
We've got about 2 minutes, David, if you've got a quick one.
Yeah, short question. I'm David Nathan.
Hi, David. I know David.
It's a kind of concrete question. I'm associated with a project that funds language documentation. And in the application form, there's this perhaps controversial requirement that the project applicant provides a letter of support from the community for the project. Now, recently, in our context, we have problematized that, but no one's really sure what to replace it with. So from this much more sort of complex and dynamic situation that you described, do you have any advice or any ideas that might inform how applicants should reflect their support coming out of the community?
Well, you know, from our experience at the Institute, where you've worked for a number of years, that's also been a contentious issue in terms of research grants that go through the Institute, and that people have to provide some evidence of collaborative involvement and support from an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander community that they're proposing that they will work with or have been working with. And a letter of support isn't always enough, is it? Because it doesn't always reflect the true nature of how the project might proceed or how the involvement of the Indigenous person or people will be kind of negotiated and worked out. And, you know, I'm currently in a project at the moment where I'm feeling very much like the token blackfella. And, you know, I think that it's a difficult process, and it can't be just a letter. Because my angst about all of that is, particularly when you've got a situation like what happens at IATSIS, is that Indigenous people put in proposals for research and regularly get knocked back because they're not academic enough. They don't have enough, you know, evidence of what's been done in the field before, and why they're not showing, you know, how they're going to further the research or work that's previously been done. And, you know, it's just a plain, straight out application. This is something I really want to do, and I'm connected to this person or people, and I'm qualified to do this because my community said I could, and I want to do it. And then they go, oh no, we can't have that. That just doesn't fit, you know. So a letter is not the answer, Dave.
Paradoxically, you're saying the letter of support perhaps should be rated higher.
Maybe in the case of that, that's the reverse situation where you've got many Aboriginal applications getting flicked away because of that. And that's been my grief with the Institute for many years, and many of us have it. So, yeah, I don't know. It's not enough, really, though. But if it was, both ways, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Thank you. That's it.
Oh, don't do that. That's
Sorry.
A bad way to finish.
Yeah, bad way to finish. Need water.
Thank you very much, Jeannie. It's a conversation I'm really reluctant to end, but we started a bit late, and so we'll try and do catch up, and Jeannie's going to be here through the conference. So we're going to take a couple of minutes now before we start the next paper, just so we can do the changeover with the PowerPoint and so forth. So our next speaker is going to be Rob Amory. I'm not going to introduce him just yet.
I've got a...
Let's just put this on pause, so...